Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi was upbeat before the U.S. Congress today, telling his audience that Iraqis were emerging from the dark ages of Saddam Hussein's rule. But the images from Iraq this week have certainly been medieval. Two American engineers beheaded on video. Images yesterday of a third bound hostage, a Briton, pleading in tears for his life. The group responsible calls itself One God and Jihad. And its reputed leader, the Jordanian-born Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, has been linked to over 200 deaths since 1992, including the beheading in May of American Nicholas Berg. That Zarqawi may have done himself. Colin Powell described him as a key link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Many doubt that. But he's on a brutal roll now. Tonight on Point, the face of the jihadi insurgency in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the man in and behind those filmed beheadings and much more. We begin tonight in Baghdad, where over the past 10 days, insurgents have ramped up their activity, seizing hostages and exploding waves of car bombs, killing hundreds of Iraqis. Michael Ware is a reporter for Time magazine covering Iraq. I asked him if Prime Minister Alawi's reassuring speech to the U.S. Congress today made an impact on Iraqis.
Well, it barely registers on the radar, quite frankly. I mean, we still have suicide bombings and car bombings. We've got combat in at least two parts of the city. We've got rest of towns surrounding the capital. What Alawi is doing and saying in New York really feels quite divorced from the situation here. I mean, in the capital, Baghdad, there's a sense of being almost under siege here. That's certainly for the internationals, the foreigners here like myself, and to a very large degree, the same goes for ordinary middle-class, hard-working Iraqi families who feel like they're in lockdown, who are still wondering if they can send their children to school. They know they certainly can't send their daughters to the markets, and they're worried about going about their daily business.
Prime Minister Alawi told Congress today that it wouldn't be easy, that the struggle would be difficult, but he said, and I quote him here, the vast majority of the Iraqi people and then are united by a vision of what life can be after Saddam Hussein. Does that ring true to you?
Well, I mean, Prime Minister Alawi really has to say that, doesn't he? I mean, he's trying to lead from the front. He's doing what he can to show that he's got the strength to unite. What I have to say is an extraordinarily disparate country. You've got large groupings of people, you've got organizations, networks, all of whom have different agendas, different visions, some of them scrambling to find some sense of being and some sense of objective and what they want to achieve. And this place really is in such a sense of paralysis, simply because of the security situation. These are warlike conditions almost. So forming a vision, let alone united, is such a far cry from just feeling safe day to day and knowing that the government is intact and you can turn to the police and the army will come to save you if that's what's necessary. There just is none of that at the moment.
Washington clearly hoping that elections in January would help knit the country together, give the government more legitimacy. Alawi pledged to the U.S. Congress that elections will take place in Iraq as scheduled, and yet we're reading the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani expressing some concern and doubt about that.
Well, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is not the only one. All but the administration here in Baghdad, led by Alawi, and Washington feel that January seems at this stage so unattainable. Large chunks of the country are simply beyond our control at this point. People feel too nervous. There's too much trepidation to be considering the elections right now. We saw Hamid Karzai guarantee that elections would take place on time as scheduled in Afghanistan, and they didn't. And when the date for Karzai's election on October 9 was finally settled, that seemed to require some arm twisting of Karzai himself to secure that secondary date. these things just can't be relied to move on schedule. I mean, the security situation here is ebbing away day by day.
The other thing that, of course, American and British audiences in particular have paid so much attention to are these beheadings and the threat of more in Iraq. How's that being received, seen, discussed by Iraqis, Michael Ware?
I think you would find a fairly wide consensus amongst ordinary Iraqis that the kidnappings and indeed the beheadings are not something that they in any way condone, nor can they tolerate. The vanguard of these acts, of this barbarity, is being led by foreign jihadis. Iraqi resistance groups are beheading. They are taking people and filming decapitations, but that's by and large Iraqi on Iraqi. That's showing what they do to so-called informants or agents of the American military or those who assist this government. The ones who are attacking the foreigners, these are foreign jihadis. Now, even the conservative Iraqi clerics, who themselves are widely suspected to be involved in the resistance, have condemned the beheadings. And this has driven a wedge through the middle of the insurgency. The foreign jihadis stand by this tactic, whereas it has alienated some of the conservative Muslims in the insurgency and certainly the nationalists. But right now, the foreign terrorists maintain the whip hand and the momentum within the insurgency through the frenetic tempo of their operations and through the money that supports them.
And what kind of structure do they have under them? Behind Zakawi and the rest, does he have widespread support? Are there safe houses? Are there Sunnis or other insurgents giving support to the foreign jihadis? What's your sense of it, Michael?
The foreign jihadis have firmly taken a foothold in the west of Iraq, using the support of local Iraqi hardline religious groups and militants, using the support of general Iraqi nationalist fighters who see different groups united against a common enemy, and using the general acquiescence of the disenfranchised people of Iraq's west and those who religiously are conservatively aligned anyway, the foreign jihadis have been able to operate freely within large swathes of this country. Entire cities are under the control of the insurgents, and much of that is being dominated by the foreign jihadis, Fallujah, Ramadi, Bakuba, Samra, which the U.S. forces are attempting to take back. The foreigners have safe houses, training facilities, bomb-making plants. They have dormitories where they're sleeping their men. They have operations in conjunction with Iraqi groups. They have their own Iraqi front groups. They have entire media offices and propaganda machines. They're very well-funded and very well-established. And I can tell you, there are terrorist camps and facilities that exist here now that 12 months ago were not in this country.
And let me ask you how they're received by the Iraqi people. We've all seen at this point from different parts of the Islamic world expressions here and there, not uncommon, of admiration or sympathy for Osama bin Laden. What about Mr. Zarqawi in Iraq? How is he received? As a villain, a hero? How do you read it?
Depends what part of the country you're in. Certainly if you're in the religious Shia south of the country, where 60% of the population reside or from whence they come, they're not big fans of Zarqawi. Zarqawi represents the Al-Qaeda kind of philosophy, that hardline Salafi sect of Islam, which sees the Shia as a natural enemy. They're distorters of the one true faith. They're the unbelievers. So the only reason that these people, you know, aren't attacking the Shia more wholesale at the moment is they're too busy attacking the multinational forces. But in pockets of the West, he's regarded with respect or favour. Well, certainly he's held in such regard that people do not attempt to interfere. He is exerting enormous influence. Now, some of that influence comes from the power of the money that he is able to channel in here from Gulf states and rich donors to the jihad. Part of it comes from intimidation. Part of it just comes from sophistication. He is able to dominate the propaganda war here so effectively, even outpacing in many regards the U.S. military's information campaigns. he is a master of the art at harnessing support and taking the momentum.
Well, it's a bloody trail, and we will hear more about it tonight. Michael Ware, always great to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Ware is a correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke with me from Baghdad. We are talking tonight about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the alleged leader of the jihadi insurgency in Iraq. What is the message you are reading in the gruesome, extreme violence of Zarqawi? Has U.S. policy contained this man or made him? And does he deserve the same price on his head as Osama bin Laden? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from southern Thailand is Rohan Gunaratna, the head of terrorism research at the Institute of Defense and Strategic Studies in Singapore. He's the author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror. Welcome, Rohan Gunaratna. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Americans have been fixated this week on the terrible images of the two American engineers and the Briton still alive, two beheadings and the fear of more to come. Mr. Zarqawi is said to be behind all this and much more in Iraq. Who is this man, Zarqawi, Rohan Gunaratna?
Mr. Zarqawi is a Jordanian-Palestinian. He served in Afghanistan in the last year of the Soviet period in Afghanistan. And subsequently, he returned back to Jordan, and he was in prison for many years. And in 1999, he was released from Jordanian custody, and then he went back to Afghanistan. And with Osama bin Laden's assistance, he built a camp in Herat, which is very close to the Iranian border. Mm. And from Afghanistan, he built a network through Iran into Iraq. And today, he has become the most active terrorist leader inside Iraq.
There's an element of mystery around this man. He's described in reports I'm reading by many people who knew him, know him, as a thug, not very sophisticated, not even Palestinian. Some reports say he was born actually in the Jordanian desert and not of Palestinian background. On the other hand, he's supposed to have orchestrated, at this point, he's alleged to have orchestrated so much terrorism in Iraq. Supposedly, the letter of this big 6,000 or 7,000-word message to al-Qaeda back in January, February, saying he was ready to try and launch precipitate civil war in Iraq. Is this a thug who just kind of drifted into Iraq, or is this a mastermind profile, Rohan Gunaratna?
Certainly, he is not a thug. It is like calling Osama bin Laden and Dr. Ayman Zawahiri thugs. These people are highly motivated. They are politically motivated. They are religiously motivated. And I can assure you that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is a Palestinian Jordanian. I can also assure you that he's been educated in this particular art of using religious ideology to achieve a political goal. While in Jordanian custody, he came under the influence of Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who is one of the key Islamist ideologues of our time. And he was mentored by Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who remains in Jordanian custody.
There's this also the question of whether or not he lost a leg somewhere along the way. He's often reported to have maybe even somehow under American weapons, but then we're seeing the latest reports that, no, he has two legs, he's up and around. This is not a Captain Ahab kind of mission that he's on. One leg or two?
There was initial intelligence that he had lost a leg and suffered injury in the chest, but now it appears that that intelligence was flawed. He's a very active terrorist. He's operationally, he's a genius. He has not only built a state-of-the-art terrorist network inside Iraq, but also he has now built a network inside Europe. His operational cells were responsible for planning to do chembio attacks in France and in Britain. Both these operations were disrupted in December of 2002 and January of 2003, respectively. Also, early this year, that is in the last week of March and the first week of April, the Jordanians disrupted a huge operation by the Zakawi network in Amman.
Rohan Gunaratne, hold the thought. We're going to learn a lot more tonight. Thanks for being with us. We're talking about the face of the jihadi insurgency in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. What's the message you're reading in the gruesome violence of Zarqawi? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the face of jihadi insurgency in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the man in and behind those filmed beheadings, and so much more. You can join the conversation tonight. You can hardly miss this man's alleged handiwork. What is the message that you are reading in the gruesome, extreme violence of Zarqawi? Has U.S. policy contained this man or made him? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Pattani, Thailand, by Rohan Gunaratne, head of terrorism research at the Institute of Defense and Strategic Studies based in Singapore. We're joined now as well from Washington by Stephen Simon. He's a senior analyst at the RAND Corporation, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America, a former senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council, 1994 to 99. Stephen Simon, thank you for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Zarqawi and al-Qaeda, is he part of it? Is he in competition with it? Is he an ally of Osama bin Laden or something else? Does it matter?
Well, I don't think it's really an important question. Al-Qaeda, depending on how you define it, is either everything or almost nothing. It's a bit of a conundrum. The arrests that took place not long ago in Pakistan, especially of Naeem Noor Khan, an al-Qaeda operative in Pakistan, seem to reveal that al-Qaeda still exist as a kind of a bureaucratic organization with a hierarchy and contacts and communication systems and so forth. So it certainly does exist. But as a practical matter, it's been franchised. Its methods have been franchised. Its message has been franchised. And I think you need to, view this as a constellation of ideologically related groups.
But I must say, it seemed to matter, Stephen Simon. In February of last year, Colin Powell went before the United Nations to make the case for the invasion of Iraq. He then very specifically called Zarqawi an associate and collaborator of Osama bin Laden. He called him part of a sinister nexus between Iraq and the al-Qaeda terrorist network. Was that true at the time, or was this, a terrorist or would-be terrorist on his own hook drifting through the Middle East?
Well, I myself haven't seen convincing evidence of collaborative links, and in fact neither has the 9/11 Commission, between the Saddam Hussein regime and al-Qaeda through the medium of Zarqawi. Zarqawi was certainly in northern Iraq for a while. The story about him not having a leg stems from one report that had circulated for a while that he was operated on in
Baghdad. Mm-hmm.
and had his leg amputated or something of that sort. But no, I see them as operationally separate. They seem to have had some contacts, but I think their approach to the jihad is different, or maybe you could say they have complementary approaches. For Osama bin Laden, I think the Holy Grail is still attacking the United States on its own soil, as he did when he orchestrated the September 11th attacks in 2001. For Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, he feels he's got his work cut out for him right there in Iraq. The Americans have brought the targets to him, and he's happy enough about that, and that is where he is going to lead his jihad. It looks as though Osama bin Laden, based on information that came out in the 9/11 Commission hearings, didn't really mind talking to the Iranians. He didn't appear to really do anything with them. Both he and the Iranians have substantial reasons not to want to have too much to do with one another. But nevertheless, he was willing to undertake some conversation with them.
Even though Iran was a Shiite power, correct, not Sunni like Osama bin Laden.
But if you're Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, dealing with the Shia is going to be completely anathema. You'd never do it because, as Rohan was saying earlier, from the perspective of Zarqawi and his mentor, Sheikh Abu Muhammad al-Makdazi, these Shiites are, they're heretics and the scum of the earth. There wouldn't be any contact. And, in fact, in that famous letter that you referred to earlier, the January Zarqawi missive, it was filled with anti-Shia vitriol, which might not be shared necessarily by Osama bin Laden.
But he was clearly fired up to get a civil war going in Iraq. Rohan Gunaratne, how do you interpret this man's ideology, his mission, his goals? How should he be understood by the rest of the world?
Zarqawi wants to attack the United States. He certainly wants to get rid of the coalition presence in Iraq. But looking at the network that he has built in Europe, about 150 of his operatives have been arrested in the past 2 years, and he has penetrated about 10 European countries. And in many ways, he's a post-Afghanistan, he has built a post-Afghanistan generation group, meaning a group that is post-Al-Qaeda, and he's willing to use chemical and biological weapons. Al-Qaeda only spoke about it, Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden, but Zarqawi in many ways is one step ahead of him. He wants to be like what Osama was in Afghanistan. He wants to have the same reputation in Iraq.
But I've seen acquaintances of Zarqawi describe him, I've read them describing him as more fanatical than bin Laden, saying bin Laden is in the middle, he's not as fanatical as al-Zarqawi. What's the extra twist that Mr. Zarqawi puts on his worldview?
I agree with you. He's a much more violent man. He has no problem whatsoever of killing Muslims to achieve his goal. I mean to say, if the Amman operation took place, it would have killed several hundred, if not a few thousand.
And what were they trying to do in Amman, Jordan, Rohan?
They were planning to attack a number of high prestige targets in Amman, which included U.S. Jordanian targets. They had built a chemical facility, and trucks full of chemicals were going to conduct suicide attacks against those targets. Fortunately, the Jordanian security service disrupted that operation.
Stephen Simon, Osama bin Laden is very clear. Essentially, he wants the United States out of the Middle East, out of the Islamic countries. He's got issues with Israel as well. What does Rohan Gunaratne, what does Mr. Zarqawi want?
Well, I think Rohan Gunaratne holds nothing against America.
Let me be very clear on that. I think we're all clear on that. A fine, upstanding man, a great scholar who we very much appreciate. But Mr. Zarqawi.
Well, Zarqawi subscribes to a particular form of radical Islam, which actually originated in Egypt, and it was referred to as the Takfir movement. And in fact, the group that he claims to head in Iraq is called Takfir, Jihad, which means Takfir and holy war. Takfir is a process of anathematization. Okay, so if I say that if I say that you're an infidel,
okay,
even if you're a fellow Muslim,
mm-hmm,
then you deserve to die. And, you know, for the Takfiris, people who hold to this notion, the whole world is an enemy that is the whole world outside of their own little group. And they often just call themselves by the word group.
Hmm.
because they're the group of true Muslims.
And let me ask you this. I'm not sure who I'm losing there. Rohan Gunaratne, are you with us? Oh, I've lost him for a second. Stephen Simon, let me ask you this then on exactly that front. Why the beheading? Why this kind of gruesome medieval way? And what about the reports, the allegations that Zarqawi has physically done at least one of these beheadings himself, actually performed the beheading? Why this way of killing it? And why would a guy with as much sway as we're hearing described tonight get down into the bloody business of actually doing it?
Well, for a number of mutually reinforcing reasons. First, Zarqawi is a thug, and he had a reputation for thuggishness in Jordan. And he does have Palestinian antecedents, but he is very much from Jordan, which is why he's called Zarqawi. He's from the city of Zarqa.
Described as Jordan's Detroit, pretty grim, crime-ridden industrial place.
It's ugly. It's ugly. Oh. And the neighborhood he came from was a very tough one.
So he's a very tough guy. He might just, I mean, it's sick thought, but he might just like it. But is there some way in which this works for him at a PR level?
Yes, well, it works for him in a number of ways in a PR level. First of all, you have to bear in mind that the Prophet had enemies decapitated in large numbers after some of the battles he waged with his enemies, so that is, that are recorded in Muslim scripture. So he's emulating the Prophet when he does this. Now, the Prophet, you know, was this was wartime, and this was a punishment visited on the enemies of the early Muslim community when it was under threat. So there's a kind of emulation there. Secondly, there are some instances, some scriptural instances, where Muslims are enjoined to slaughter their enemies, and this is a particular way of slaughter, right? I mean, to slit the throat,
without question,
remove the head. And if you look at the last will, as it's called, of Muhammad Atta, the ringleader of the September 11th mm-hmm. attackers, this document, which was found in their luggage, which didn't make it onto the flight, instructed the hijackers to slaughter their victims. And the Arabic word in that instance for slaughter suggests, among other things, you know, cultic slaughter, that is, you know, slaughter on the altar. So it resonates in that way. Finally, it's a pretty powerful image. If you have, you know, seen one of these videotapes, the victim is grabbed by his hair, and the head is pulled back.
They're bound. They're on their knees.
And precisely, they're howling for mercy, and their head is cut off.
You're not getting it. Yeah.
This is an image that once you've seen, you don't forget it. Mm. It's extremely powerful. So, you know, the huge impact that these images have really works tremendously in his favor. Those who believe in his cause are inspired by these very ugly and appalling images. At the same time, the impunity with which he appears to be able to do this, and even, as you were pointing out, participate in these acts on a personal basis, is a vivid demonstration of the impotence of American military power in Iraq.
Yeah, it gives an image of power. Let's turn to a caller. Andy is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks. I just wanted to bring to your attention a report by NBC News from March 2nd, 2004.
Yeah.
And they reported that prior to the war, Zarqawi was living in northern Iraq, and that the Pentagon on three different occasions drew up plans to attack him, but the administration would not follow through on it because it would undercut its case for war against Saddam.
You mean if Zarqawi wasn't there, they wouldn't have the alleged link to al-Qaeda, and that would fall apart?
Right.
I don't know. Rohan Gunaratne, what do you make of that? Has the United States been fully vigorous in its pursuit? They're offering $25 million for Zarqawi now.
The U.S. government realized the importance of Zarqawi only much later. Of course, immediately after U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, they recovered substantial documents that indicated that Zarqawi was a part of the Al-Qaeda network. However, it was only towards last year that the U.S. government realized his importance, that operationally he was the most active Al-Qaeda associate and that it was necessary to target him specifically, and that's why today he has he's such a wanted man. I'm saying his level of he has a $25 million reward on his head, and that shows his importance.
Rohan, let me ask you this. If there's anything at all to what Prime Minister Alawi was saying to the U.S. Congress today, that the values of liberty and democracy are being picked up, are eagerly sought by many Iraqis, why don't Iraqis turn on men doing gruesome things like Zarqawi? Why don't they capture him, tie him up, deliver him to authorities? How does he operate with such apparent impunity in the country?
In any conflict zone, most people are silent. They don't want to get involved in this. There's a lot of fear involved in it. And much of the Iraqis who are the good Iraqis will not go out of their way because of the huge element of fear. It's a huge fear psychosis. The Prime Minister, in many ways, he spelled out a vision for Iraq. It is not what is really happening in Iraq today.
And Stephen Simon, we've just got a minute or so left here, but the violence and the sophistication, apparently, of Zarqawi, how do you see it influencing this conflict? How do you see it pushing the violence and the conflict in Iraq? In what direction? What impact?
Well, it's going to cause the violence to spiral. Every time the United States targets a safe house and, say, attacks it with a bomb from the air.
And they've done that just this week.
Correct. It's a surgical strike. It kills a Zarqawi associate, but it also kills civilians. Mm. A 1,000-pound bomb hitting a house on a city block, will take down that building, but it will kill a lot of people, and that's just how it is. But this propels a cycle of violence because each time, non-combatant Iraqis are killed, if I can put it that way, especially children, it generates a need for revenge killings, and then it just spirals.
And very quickly, though, he's against Shiites. If he continues to prosper, that must mean a move towards civil war.
Well, it's going to sharpen internecine conflicts and tensions, and the Shia are going to be very threatened by this kind of thing.
Not to mention the Americans and anybody else that comes into his web. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Stephen Simon, terrific to have you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Stephen Simon, senior analyst at the RAND Corporation, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, and our good Rohan Gunaratne in Puttani, Thailand. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Rohan Gunaratne, author of Inside Al-Qaeda. In a moment, President Bush and interim Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi face reporters in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Interim Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi brought a message of reassurance to Capitol Hill today, telling a joint session of Congress that the, quote, values of liberty and democracy are taking hold in his country. In a press conference after the speech in the White House Rose Garden, Alawi was joined by President Bush, who once again vowed to stay the course in Iraq. It was a rare chance for journalists to question the president directly, and many of their questions were sharper-edged than in past press conferences.
Mr. President, Mr. Prime Minister, I'd like to ask about the Iraqi people. Both of you have spoken for them today, and yet over the past several months there have been polls conducted by the Coalition Provision Authority, by the Oxford Institute and other reputable organizations that have found very strong majorities do not see the United States as a liberator but as an occupier, are unhappy with American policy, and want us out. Don't the real voices of the Iraqi people themselves contradict the rosy scenarios you're painting here today.
Let me start by that. You said the poll was taken when the CPA was there? Yeah, okay, let me stop you. First of all, the Iraqi people now have got Iraqi leadership. Prime Minister Alawi and his cabinet are making decisions on behalf of the Iraqi people. Secondly, I saw a poll that said the right track, wrong track in Iraq was better than here in America. It's pretty darn strong. I mean, the people see a better future. Well, talk to the leader. I agree. I'm not the expert on how the Iraqi people think, because I live in America, where it's nice and safe and secure. But I talked to this man. One reason I'm optimistic about our ability to get the job done is because I talked to the Iraqi prime minister.
Then that prime minister, Alawi, stepped to the microphone in the Rose Garden and echoed President Bush's optimism.
Iraq is made out of 18 provinces. 18. Out of these 18 provinces, 14 to 15 are completely safe. There are no problems. And I can count them for you, starting from Basra, moving into Iraq, Kurdistan. There are three provinces where there are pockets of insurgents, pockets of terrorists who are acting there and are moving from there to inflict damage elsewhere in the country. So really, if you care to look at Iraq properly and go from Basra to Nasiriyah, to Kut, to Diyala, to Najaf, to Karbala, to Diwaniya, to Sumawa, to Kirkuk, to Sulaymaniyah, to Dahuk, to Erbil, there are no problems. It's safe, it's good. There are problems in Fallujah. Fallujah is part of a province. The province is called Al-Anbar. It's a vast, very big. It has many other important towns, such as Ana, such as Rawa, such as Rumadi. There is nothing there. In Ana and Rawa and here, there is nothing, no problem, except on a small pocket in Fallujah. So really, I call upon the responsible media throughout the world, not only here, to look at the facts as they are in Iraq and to propagate these facts to the international community.
There, President Bush and Iraqi Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi in the Rose Garden at the White House today after Prime Minister Alawi's address to a joint session of Congress. We'll hear more from that press conference. It was quite an interesting one. But joining me first is Michael Hirsch, senior editor covering international affairs for Newsweek magazine. Michael Hirsch, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
First, to Prime Minister Alawi. He addressed the joint session today. It's a very prominent venue indeed. What kind of impression is he making?
A very good one. It was an excellent speech. It was to the point, relatively brief. It hit all of the key points that the Bush administration has tried to, which some of which you just heard in your clip from the Rose Garden news conference, how things were much better than they seem. He and the internal Iraqi government were determined to carry off elections, and most Iraqis profoundly reject the chaos that's being fomented by the insurgents and reject the aims of the insurgents.
You heard the pushback there in the press conference in the first question that we had asked here, citing polls taken by American officials and others in Iraq, contradicting or appearing to contradict this notion that Iraqis were falling in line behind an American plan or vision there. It was a testier press conference than we've seen President Bush face in some time, was it not?
Well, he has every reason to be defensive. I mean, he and Alawi and his administration are, you know, continuing to put a gloss on what is becoming a worsening and ever more chaotic situation. There's absolutely no question about it. There's no longer discussion of quote-unquote winning in Iraq. We're just trying, U.S. troops are trying to survive there. Contrary to what Alawi was suggesting, attacks have occurred in many parts of the country. What you have there now is at the heart of Iraq, and some of these, particularly the Sunni provinces, you have enclaves of insurgents who are controlling cities like Fallujah and can pretty much do what they want. And, of course, their only benchmark of success is to you know, kill more Americans or kill more Iraqis lining up to become police recruits or whatever. As long as they can continue that, the country will continue to persist in a state of fear. There's virtually no reconstruction taking place anymore because of all the problems. So it's a very, very dire situation.
There was plenty of reference to that today in the questions. Let's hear another exchange here from the Rose Garden with President Bush here with the CIA's national intelligence estimate brought up by one of the reporters. Of course, that painted a less rosy picture than President Bush has of what's going on in Iraq. Also reference here to General Abizaid, commander of U.S. troops in the Middle East, and his comment before a congressional committee on Wednesday that more troops might be needed, American or Iraqi. Let's listen.
Sir, I'd like you to answer Senator Kerry and other critics who accuse you of hypocrisy or opportunism when, on the one hand, you put so much stock in the CIA when it said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and now say it is just guessing when it paints a pessimistic picture of the political transition. And I'd like to, if you don't mind, follow on something the Prime Minister just said. If General Abizaid says he needs more troops and the Prime Minister says he does not want more troops, who wins?
Let me talk to General Abizaid. As I said, he just came in to see me, and I want to make sure. I'm not suggesting any of the reporters here might be taking something out of context. That would never happen in America. But nevertheless, I do want to sit down and talk to him about it. Obviously, we could work this out. I mean, it's in the, it's, if our commanders on the ground feel it's in the interest of the Iraq citizens to provide more troops, we'll talk about it. That's why they're friends. That's what we do about friends. First part of the question?
Got it.
Listen, the other day I was asked about the NIE, which is a national intelligence estimate. This is a report that talks about possibilities about what can happen in Iraq, not probabilities. I used an unfortunate word, guess. I should have used estimate. And CIA came and said, this is a possibility, this is a possibility, and this is a possibility. But what's important for the American people to hear is reality. And the reality is right here in the form of the Prime Minister. And he is explaining what is happening on the ground. That's the best report. And this report was written in July, and now we are here in September. And as I said, estimate would have been a better word.
President Bush, again, at the Rose Garden today. Michael Hirsch of Newsweek is with us. Michael, the President says, let's look at reality in Iraq. That's the best test here. And as you noted earlier, Prime Minister Alawi got quite a warm, positive reception at Congress today with his pretty warm and positive message. And yet, from Capitol Hill, even from the president's own party, there have been some sharp words of criticism and quite dark depictions lately of what's going on in Iraq. How do these things fit together?
Well, I mean, what's actually going on right now, as you know, Tom, and as most of your listeners know, is the presidential election campaign. And I can tell you one thing almost for certain, that up until November 2nd, the Bush administration will continue to say things are going fairly well in Iraq. But reporters on the ground, those of us who reported the story, can conclude that it is a desperate situation there in which, as I suggested earlier, it's very easy for the insurgents to continue to succeed by simply killing more Iraqis and Americans. There is now talk of trying to invade insurgent enclaves like Fallujah, but that sounds disconcertingly like what we did during Vietnamization, where we tried to bomb Cambodian sanctuaries, and then, you know, that didn't work. Because what's happened here is that even though the official rhetoric from the administration is still that we're, you know, creating a good ally and a stable model in the Arab world, something like what we did to post-war Germany, in reality, what we're doing is really something close to Vietnamization, where we're rushing to try to hand off the country to ill-prepared Iraqi security forces. In the meantime, U.S. troops are hunkered down. And I think what most of the critics, including some of the Republicans like Senator Chuck Hagel, are saying is, look, we've got to have a reckoning with you know, what the end game might be. I mean, we're going to have to be there for several years. Americans are going to continue to suffer casualties for a long time to come because there is no immediate prospect at all that's been laid out for stopping this insurgency.
The campaign aspect of this was also put out on the table, in effect, in the Rose Garden today, when one reporter asked President Bush about the way he's describing what's going on in Iraq. Let's listen to that.
You say today that the work in Iraq is tough and will remain tough, and yet you travel this country, and a central theme of your campaign is that America is safer because of the invasion of Iraq. Can you understand why Americans may not believe you?
No. Anybody who says that we're safer with Saddam Hussein in power is wrong. We went into Iraq because Saddam Hussein defied the demands of the free world. We went into Iraq after diplomacy had failed. And we went into Iraq because I understand after September the 11th, we must take threats seriously before they come to hurt us. And I think it's a preposterous claim to say that America would be better off with Saddam Hussein in power. I certainly know that that's the case for America, and I certainly know it's the case for the Iraqi people. These are the people who were tortured. This good man was abed in a London flat, and he wakes up with two Saddam henchmen there with axes, trying to cut him to pieces with an axe. And fortunately, he's alive today. Fortunately, we call him friend and ally. But he knows what it means to have lived under a society in which a thug like Saddam Hussein would send people with axes to try to kill him in bed in a London flat. Now, this world is better off with Saddam Hussein in prison.
Sir, may I just follow? Because King, I don't think you're really answering the question. I think you're responding to Senator Kerry. Where there are beheadings regularly, the insurgent violence continues, and there are no weapons of mass destruction. My question is, can you understand that Americans may not believe you when you say that America is actually safer today?
Imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein were still in power. This is a man who harbored terrorists, Abu Abbas, Abu Nadal, Zarqawi. This is a man who was a sworn enemy of the United States of America. This is a man who used weapons of mass destruction. Going from tyranny to democracy is hard work. But I think the argument that says that Saddam Hussein, if Saddam Hussein were still in power, we'd be better off, is wrong.
Michael Hirsch, forgive me if I've just missed it, but that kind of sharp question and sharp follow-up is something I don't think I've heard much of for a long time in this administration.
No, you haven't. One of the reasons for it is because at long last, the campaign debate between Kerry and Bush has finally sharpened, by which I mean Kerry is now taking on Bush on the whole question of how he conducted the war on terror, which the war in Iraq is part of. And Bush continues to sidestep the real criticism. No one is suggesting that Saddam should still be in power. I mean, everyone agrees that he was an evil guy. The real question has always been, was this a wise move at this juncture? Did we waste our resources, squander our attention on something that it turns out was not a critical threat? And, of course, that Bush continues to sidestep that as well. There was no evidence.
Let's hear a little bit of John Kerry in Columbus, Ohio, today on this point.
I think the prime minister is obviously contradicting his own statement of a few days ago where he said the terrorists are pouring into the country. The prime minister and the president are here, obviously, to put their best face on the policy.
But so far, Michael Hirsch, in the polls, President Bush continues to lead. The picture that he's putting forward, the hope that he's putting forward, seems to be playing politically.
Yeah, I think what's happened is that the Bush campaign and the Bush administration have really successfully sold the idea that the war in Iraq was an intrinsic part of the war on terror, indeed a central front, as Bush said, that image, that sort of grand construct has gone unchallenged by Kerry for a long time. One of the reasons that Kerry, I believe, is lagging in the polls. But a week ago or so, Kerry, delivered a speech in which he finally sort of made this sharp critique that Iraq was a grand diversion from the real war against al-Qaeda, against bin Laden. And so I think you are going to see the campaign debate over this sharpen up. And I believe that over the next, month or so, Bush is going to have to do a much better job than he did today in responding to this criticism. Was the hugely expensive, both in blood and dollars, effort to take on Saddam a diversion?
Well, we will be listening. Michael Hirsch, terrific of you to join us. Thanks so much for coming on.
Happy to have done it. Thank you.
Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.